Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 18, Episode 34. In which Bob attempted to give us a Just the Facts rundown of the timeline in the Delphi case, and with promises to give us some more big pieces to take a look at together as a group. This is, of course, following some of the conversations that he's had with some of our wonderful guests about the experience of watching the trial. Now, Bob is breaking down some facts that you can find inside of those transcripts for those people who weren't there. And I'm excited to dig into it. We got lots of listener interaction, and I'm looking forward to talking about it. But before we do that, do we have any housekeeping?
Nothing pressing right now. I think we got several listener questions, so we can go ahead and get into this. I'm curious.
And we're sans Zach today. I'm so sorry, everybody. I was staring at the outline because we do really have a lot of stuff from listeners, and I forgot to mention that, but we miss him, of course.
Yeah, and the outline says, intro, Zach.
Yes, it does. Why, yes, it does. We're running a theory right now that we're the same person. Yeah, because we're never here at the same time anymore.
Yeah, we never have to, both of you in the same room. Yeah, I think I'm finding, I've already recorded next week's episode. This is going to be a three-parter. This episode that's coming on Sunday is going to be the firearms analysis and then some kind of little stuff that we've talked about along the way, like regarding Richard Allen's height, the height span that was given. What Libby said in the video, whether it was Richard Allen's voice and the recording, that type of stuff. So we go over that this weekend. But what I've noticed is, like, as I've gone through everything to this point, is like nobody is like making up facts. Like nobody's making up or leaving out facts. But what I'm finding is everybody just seems on both sides just puts a little bit of a spin on every little thing that kind of warps it. And what it does is it makes either argument seem, to me at least, incredibly strong when you just put just one little perspective shift onto what was said. And as I mentioned in last week's follow-up, and I'm curious what you thought about this, Janet, when I went through the actual timeline stuff, I found that there was, you know, my biggest takeaway was it had never really occurred to me how important Betsy Blair's testimony was. In my opinion, when I'm reading it, I'm like, of all this stuff, the thing that really matters is that.
Yeah.
And how that connects to what Richard Allen said. Well, did you have any big takeaways from the episode?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that. And I think for that reason, my first thought when listening to it was like, I wonder if he's going to be able to refrain from analysis. And you even said yourself, like, I really don't. I'm really planning not to, but that is so different. It's like when a teenager is like, and I'm planning to be home by curfew. You're like, well, you didn't say you're for sure going to be home by curfew.
Yeah, I'm doing my best.
It's hard for you not to, especially when you're giving out the information. It's just, I know it's hard not to kind of give a little bit of a, you know, an opinion or a thought about even just, yes, the reliability or the changing of certain pieces when you're talking about people's testimony. But yeah, I mean, that is so key. And I think it is very good that she seemed so credible and that she was consistent and didn't try to expand out and kind of, you know, embellish the experience that she had. I think all of that is so key. And again, it just hits home for me. The thing that we've all been saying, you know, when you re-release that episode with Nick,
mm-hmm.
it's just it's still the same thing in some ways that everyone was saying from the very beginning, which was, we have video. We have right. his voice. How do we not know who this is? And people are still saying that, and there's someone in prison. That is wild. No wonder this is a case that's going to be talked about forever in law classes, you know?
Yeah, it's crazy. All these years later, a trial, everything that's come out, it's like we all just wanted the trial. To me, I guess I'll speak for myself. Like, I just wanted the trial to just like end the questions. And I went into it, as I've said many times, like expecting like, this is where all the bullshit is going to get put aside, all the narratives, all the stuff people saying, we're going to get like, here is the proof positive. And then I came out of it like, that's it?
Right.
Like, still?
Right.
I'm just still really, and the fact that it comes down to, for me, like, and by the way, as far as analysis goes, I'm going to give you a little heads up. I failed miserably. Right. At not giving any analysis in the episode that's coming up.
Okay, so, well, I would say that I feel you gave quite a bit of analysis in this one, so.
Well, I tried to, a lot of this one was to try to like really pin down the time. Like, for example, like, you know, people have said, you know that the group of girls saw Richard Allen or saw a bridge guy at 2:15, try to make clear the trial record does not support that. It does not say. She never says it was at 2:15. She estimates maybe around. We only have. So there was some analysis. And I know I got a little bit more into it with the firearms evidence. I think about halfway through the episode, I think I say shit. Like, I just like, I've been this whole time like, and this means this. And what the hell is this? And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, kudos for you to try to control yourself. And again, you know, kudos to Anya and Kevin for, again, you know, we're talking about this. We're saying like, oh, we're still talking about it. And oh, why didn't we get more definitive proof? And then you have people like Kevin and Anya who believe that the proof is definitive enough for them, but they still are respectful towards people who are like, it's not there for me. And I just right. appreciate that, because I know that we can all get very much in our corners when it's about something with the stakes that are this high, both for the person in prison and, of course, for the families and the people that were lost. So I really mm-hmm. appreciate that everyone is still, you know, really trying to see each other's points of view. I have a few notes. I just got a chance to look at the outline. I did want to like skim through it really quickly to make sure I wasn't going to like jump on someone else's question, because if we can get it from a listener, it's, I think, a lot more interesting and dynamic than getting it from me or Zach. But I don't see this particular question. So I have something real specific that we can kind of get into. Okay. But in general, I think, yeah, it was really good. It was very helpful. I think there are still, it left me and I think other listeners for sure with some other questions about just feeling a lack of confidence in the total number of people interviewed and just a feeling of like, yes, we can all definitively say all these people were found. Everyone was talked to. And I don't want to jump into that too much because, again, we do have a great listener comment about that. But it did highlight still some things, you know, without any analysis necessarily, but just highlight some things where, it is just this like, gosh, I wish I knew. I guess I wish this were in the transcripts. I wish this had been said and acknowledged or stipulated to. I just wish we all felt like, yep, we crossed every box, you know, checked every box. And I know that's really hard in a trial, just like it is an investigation. We all have 20/20 vision. But that's also why we do this. And we're all detail-oriented people who like to get into those details. So when they're missing, it's just a feeling of like, oh, I would love to have really seen a list of every single right. person and know that none of their interviews were lost and all that stuff.
Yeah. And the problem we have here is, and there are plenty of shortcomings on the law enforcement side. I don't view this as one of them, as there's no way to know if everyone that was on the trail was accounted for, because it's not like you had to sign in. There's no entry. There's no tickets. You know, the people that like came and went during that time didn't know there was a problem. Anyone that did come forward was, you know, once the news broke and they're like, hey, if you were on the trail, come forward. And it's another one of those things. It's another perspective issue, right? Where if you are on the Richard Allen is guilty side of the argument, then you feel very comfortable saying, listen, they asked for anybody that was there to come forward. Surely anyone that was there would have come forward. And so I'm confident in saying that everyone that was at the trail was interviewed that day. If you're on the Richard Allen is innocent side, then you're saying, like, we have no idea. Like, we talked to these people, but there could have been 20 more people there that never came forward that we never heard from and we don't know. So that's something that is just like a logistical nightmare. I think law enforcement did what they could have done, which is to say, you know, you'll put out as many public places as possible. If you were there, come forward. But there's just, I don't think there's just any way for them to know for sure if everyone did.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is like a small community, but I know that also people would come in from elsewhere. I mean, I would imagine that people, yeah, that everybody who came forward at some point heard about it, unless they were, you know, people have different reasons for, again, like, maybe this is just only happens in novels and TV shows, but like, I don't know, you know, if someone like uses that place to like cheat on their husband. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, or you go there because like you're secretly growing a little bit of weed, but I don't know. I'm using these very fictional sounding like big plot, good. But you know what I'm saying? Like, why else would you come forward, you know?
Yeah, but those are good reasons, but there's also like the very not as strong of a reason, which is just like, I'm just not getting involved in this. We've seen that in literally every case we've ever worked. There's always people that like never came forward because they just didn't want to get involved.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the West Memphis Three and all the witnesses over the years that were tracked down who, you know, didn't come forward at the time. Those 3 8-year-old boys were murdered, you know, and they were, you know, they were going door to door and searching all over the place. So it's, yeah, I don't think there has to be a big reason for someone to have been like, huh, well, yeah, I don't think I saw anything important.
Yeah.
Because that's the other problem, is a lot of people don't know that what they saw was important.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me just quickly jump in. We have a couple of questions about height, but so I think maybe we can fold in some height stuff as soon as I finish kind of my thing, which was, I think the things I wanted to know are, number one, when you say that Richard Allen was 5'4", I have definitely heard or read different taller heights. I'm just wondering, I just want to be clear, did everyone, the defense and the state, did everyone stipulate to the fact that Richard Allen is 5'4"? That's my first question.
My understanding, the reason there's a question in that is because his fishing license listed him as 5'6". I believe when he was booked in the jail, and I think his driver's license, and I think from my under, because I did some searching on this a couple of weeks ago, and it was from everything I was able to find, he is in fact 5'4". But remember, they made a whole deal about the fact that his fishing license said 5'6", and they're like, oh, that he had lied about, you know, that to try to create a false record or something, which I think
you're a guy who's 5'4", living in the world that we live in, you probably just embellish your height because we're mean to shorter guys, which is not cool. Putting Richard Allen aside, it would make sense to me that I think people do, and women feel more like they should make themselves sound like they weigh less in a driver's license or fishing license or whatever. Okay, so I guess my next question is like, you know, I tend to wear, like if I'm wearing a pair of boots, that can put a couple of inches on me. So I'm just curious about that. Like, okay, we're saying 5'4", but like, again, 5'4 is pretty short for a guy. It seems like that's below average for a white American man. But, you know, I just wanted to throw out there, like, you know, I have friends who are, you know, 6'3", and they put on their, like, you know, their Timberlands, and they're like 7 feet. I mean, of course, they're not that tall, but I'm like, damn, that added like 3 inches to your height. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, I mean, unless he was wearing platform shoes, I mean, most work boots or anything like that, that, you know, they're going to add an inch to you. I don't think it's enough that, you know, it's not going to add inches to your height.
Yeah.
Unless you were wearing something specifically to do that.
Right. And then my next question is, you know, when I'm hiking hills. So I don't know this landscape. Of course, I know that the bridges are bridges, so they're not hilly. But I guess my question is, like, if I'm hiking up or down one of the trails near my house, if someone passes me, where we are in geological or geographical proximity to each other based on, you know, like I'll see a person who's pretty small, but they seem tall to me because they're coming downhill and I'm going uphill mm-hmm. and they pass me and I'm not thinking about it. All I know is when I see them from 5 feet away, they seem a lot taller than they are. So I'm just opening that up again, just trying to kind of ask those questions. It's not in the trial. I understand that that's not a fact in the transcript. I'm just trying to like make room for, and then also just the idea of like eyewitnesses, you know, getting stuff wrong anyway. I'm just trying to think openly about, because that's my experience, is I feel like I'm really tall because I walked down past someone, but actually they were way taller than me. That's all.
Yeah, and I can try to pull up a topographical map, but for my recollection, I think it's pretty flat. Like there's certainly no like big steep climbs on the trail. I think it's a pretty flat trail.
Okay. And then I also was just curious. Well, that's the height stuff. So let's continue on with the height conversation. Aaron says, I still honestly don't know what to believe other than that Betsy Blair most likely saw the killer. At a distance of approximately 50 feet, I think someone could recognize that a man was particularly short, and 5'4 is noticeably short for an adult man. What I still cannot get past is the prosecution apparently never asked the crucial dot connecting question, is Bridge Guy in this courtroom? If no testimony ever established that Bridge Guy was the same person as the defendant, I can't understand how anyone could find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. To me, that missing link is the very definition of reasonable doubt. So let's address the height thing first with Betsy. Yeah, just the idea of seeing someone from far away. And
I think that all depends on perspective, like what you have to compare it to, because from 50 feet, and 50 feet is not super far away. Just to give you an idea, if you're trying to think of distance, if you're like familiar with a baseball field, from the pitcher's mound to home plate is 60 feet. So it's closer than that.
Yeah.
So you're not like...
Sorry, I didn't mean to say that was super far away. I wasn't even thinking about that. I was just saying like from seeing from a distance. Yeah, seeing close or seeing from a distance, either way.
Yeah. It would seem to me that, yeah, you would notice if somebody was noticeably short. But like, I don't know some details. It could be like if the railing on the bridge was shorter than normal, than maybe like the 42 inches you might expect, that would make somebody look taller. Or if it was taller than normal, it would make somebody look shorter. There's a lot of variable. I don't think any of that stuff is relevant. I tend to agree. That's one of the biggest things. I'm pretty comfortable after reading the testimony in the fact that Wilbur and Voorhees, the group of four girls, the two that testified, that they did not see Richard Allen. I personally cannot reconcile their description of the person they saw and the consistency between the two of them with that having been Richard Allen. With Betsy Blair, it's a different story. She didn't walk past him. She didn't interact with him. And again, what I think, you know, is Janet, you always bring this up about, you know, how bad eyewitness identification is. I cannot stress enough how little attention people pay to very specific details when they don't know they need to be paying attention. It's bad enough when they do know they need to be paying attention. But when she walks up and sees this fella up on the bridge, like she remembers seeing them. But I don't have confidence in her, whether she's saying he's tall or he's short. Like, again, I think that, was it Brandon, whoever was the listener who put that question in?
Aaron.
I tend to agree that if somebody is like really short person, like that's memorable, or a really tall person, that's memorable. But I also don't even know if 5'4" wearing boots fall, like that's short. If you're walking past them, you're certainly going to notice that difference. But glancing at somebody, I don't know that that is so noticeably short where it would like stick in your mind, even without needing to remember, just like glancing at somebody like, oh, look at that's a, you know. Like if there was like a little person up there, like you would notice, like,
right.
I noticed there was a little person there, or a child, or a super tall person.
Yeah,
he's definitely well below average for height, but I don't know if he's short enough that from a distance at a glance that you're going to notice that or remember that.
I would also say too, and I was looking to see if this came up, but in my opinion, and again, this is the place where we are doing opinion and kind of talking about all of this and hashing it out. Because, again, this is not what was brought up at trial. This is just us talking, especially about kind of not just professional analysis, but also like the way that jurors see things and the way the jurors process information, and knowing that, you know, we are this species that is a comparative species. Like, we want to put things in boxes. We want to understand that we compare other people's experiences to our own experiences. We compare oh, I would never grieve like that. I would grieve like this. Therefore, right. This person is guilty. Like, it's really hard to break those habits. So I know I'm saying something from experience. I can only speak from my own experience. But when a guy is kind of husky or muscular, I tend to think of him as taller than he is. Like, you know, I dated someone who was a couple of inches shorter than me, and I never remember that he was shorter than me because he was built like you. And you just don't, like, his head was way bigger than mine. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I always would think, oh, he's taller than me. And then we would be standing next to each other barefoot, and I would be like, oh, no, I'm like 2 inches taller than this person. So I think that's the frame, the build, to use a word that I know was in the FBI, that to me also affects how you perceive someone's height. Is like, what is their build? Are they, you know, male presenting, female presenting? Are they husky? Are they muscular? You know, how big is their head? All of that stuff like does factor in to how you process height, especially if you're not, I would imagine, especially if you're not knowing that you need to remember something.
Yeah. And just from the chat, Lynn in the chat says, Alan was on a platform on the bridge much further than Betsy Blair thought. And he was sitting, unsure how she estimated a height.
He was sitting. I thought he was leaning and looking into the water. I don't know.
Yeah. I know Lynn's done a ton of research on this, but I don't remember that, but that's possible. But yeah, the distance too, like that's another thing. She estimates about 50 feet. It could be significantly further than that where it was at. But the, you know, the same thing. So like right under there, you know, purple in the chat says, Betsy Blair described a young man with poofy hair. And that's, again, that's a way we could say, if you read the testimony, she didn't say that it was a young man with poofy hair. Like, she's very unclear. She's not unclear, but very unsure. Like her testimony shows that she's very unsure about, could have been poofy hair. It could have been a hood. It could have been, I might be conflating two people's, but all of them. I didn't read from anybody's testimony that they were like 100%. I'm certain they had poofy hair. And again, like you know, and hers, you know, she didn't say it was definitely a young man. She said, I don't know, it could be, you know, 20s or 30s. I want to say that she said she thought maybe 20s or 30s could be, but again, was wishy-washy. Yeah, so Lynn said she seemed to recall sitting, but she's not positive about that. Yeah, I don't recall.
I'm not either. I mean, don't listen to me. I mean,
I just read it, and I feel like I would remember if there was sitting, but I don't think there was any sitting. But also, as far as height, she wasn't real, Betsy Blair wasn't like super clear on height. You know, she didn't say, oh, the person was 5'10", 20 years old, poofy hair. It wasn't, none of it was that clear with her. You know, she was very clear in her testimony that she had this kind of fleeting glance. She wasn't really paying attention. She kind of recalls that it was, I believe what she said was, seemed to be maybe average height, if I'm remembering correctly. And then there was these questions about, you know, the poofy hair, but then there was all, like with a lot of the witnesses, it was like, well, it could have been a hood. Maybe it was poofy hair. Maybe it was hair. Maybe it was a hood. It was all very, and again, you know, as I mentioned last week, there's, you know, you have officers, once you have somebody who saw the, you know, a person matching bridge guy's description saying he had like poofy blonde hair sticking out from his hood or from his hat, whatever. It's reasonable that when other people come forward and they're saying, well, what do you remember? Could he have had poofy hair? And then, you know, memories are malleable.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad that you threw that in there as like a, listen to how innocent this is when you're just trying to establish, you know, trying to establish something. The difference between asking an open-ended question, like, did you happen to notice what kind of hair they had versus did you notice that they had poofy hair? It's such an innocent thing to do. But it could totally change someone's memory.
Well, yeah, especially if you're like the state of mind, there's a lot of study, and I'm certainly no expert on this, but I've read a lot about it. And it seems like there's like when your brain is in the process of trying to, and that's why people can be so impressionable in interrogations. Like when you're in the process, it's one of the reasons why the Reed techniques ends up being dangerous for innocent people, too. When you're genuinely trying to recall something is happening. This would be a good Dr. Shiloh question or Dr. Scott, but like something's happening in your brain where you're literally trying to build the memory, right? So you're trying to recall details and you're trying to build the memory. When somebody pops something into your head in the middle of that process, it's like, you know, this is a complete layman idiot version, but it's the way I understand it. It's like, it just like slides right in there and it just, oh, that fills that gap nicely and that becomes the memory.
Yeah.
You know, so if it's like, well, what color was his hair? Like, oh, let me think. Well, he was walking by. I remember walking by. Was his hair poofy? There was. It was poofy hair. You know what I mean? Like, because it's like you're in the process of trying to reconstruct this in your brain when something like that gets thrown at you.
Yeah.
Like, that's just one of the many ways that memories, you know, get manipulated on accident, not, you know, not for any nefarious reason.
And now imagine the stress of a good person wanting to help. I mean, that is heartbreaking to me, just to know that those girls, you know, all of these witnesses being like, oh my gosh, this horrible thing happened to two wonderful kids. And like, I could be the key. I mean, I can't even imagine how that would mess with you. Like, I have so much compassion for everyone who was a part of the case, and I'm sure wanted to, you know, have something that would be the key, and, you know, to then, but also not want to get something wrong. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's terrible. And that's the thing is, like, I, you know, people sometimes will tend to like demonize witnesses like this, but, you know, because maybe they got something wrong, or maybe they were wishy-washy in what they were saying. It's like, yeah, like there's, this is not a situation where we've seen in other cases where somebody, like, clearly, whether it was through police coercion or by trying to protect somebody else, where they're like, you know, he said JoJo did it, you know, that type of thing. It's not that. Like, these are witnesses who are just genuinely doing their best to try and help because they think maybe they know something that could help.
Yeah.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Staying with height for a moment, Sonia says, when you relayed the heights of the girls who were part of the group of four, was that their height at trial, great question, or their height at the time of the murder? Because if it was their height at trial, maybe they were shorter years prior, therefore being shorter than RA. That's such a great analytical, thoughtful, investigative question, Sonia. I'm so glad your brain went there.
Yeah, it really is something I didn't think about, but I did go try to do some research on this. I think most likely the answer is probably the same. So age at the time of the murder, during the testimony comes out that they were, like Voorhees specifically was the one who was 5'7", was 16 at the time of the murders. You know, so that would put her, what, like 23, 24 years old at the time. So I was even like doing research, like when do girls typically reach their full height? And it's typically, you know, around 15, 16. So like 16 years old, I don't know when her birthday was. She was close to 17. You know, it's possible she had a little bit more growing to do, but it seems like kind of the norm is probably at full height at 16 years old. So it probably didn't change very much. That said, that there, it's never like that's never spelled out. Like nobody ever asked on the stand, have you grown? You know, you were 5'7" when then how tall are you now? That never came up. But also she did say on the stand, she estimated that the person she passed, she estimated his height to be about 5'10". So in her mind, when she's saying I was 5'7", he was taller than me. And then when she's asked, like, how, you know, and that might have even, if I remember correctly, the way the exact exchange worked, to be accurate, I don't think they said, how tall do you think he was? I think they might have repeated back her, like, witness statement from back then to her, where they said, you know, you said 5'10", could that be accurate? And she, and again, not strong, but, you know, she said, you know, something to the extent of, yeah, that could be right. That seems about right, or something like that.
Yeah. This is none of my business. It's not about judgment at all. It's just a genuine curiosity. But I'm so curious if those witnesses who did testify I'm so curious if they think that estimating someone was, you come up to your, you know, their middle arm and then you know how tall the person on trial is. I guess this has neither here nor there. I just, from a personal human being side of things, I wonder if those witnesses are like, yeah, I guess he must have been 5'4". Like, if they believe that he's guilty, like, or yeah. If they're like, God, I really felt like he was so much taller. I'm really uncomfortable with this. Again, none of my business, but I'm just curious. Sorry,
they may not even know how tall Richard Allen is. You know, he would have been sitting down at the defense table.
They wouldn't have been in trial to hear a conversation about his height.
No, yeah, they would have been sequestered during all of that. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, personally, I know like Lynn's making some points in the chat about different reasons. You know, like someone who's intimidating could seem taller. I just, for me, like I always say there's always certain anchors that stick out to me that are more meaningful to me. And to me, that's just one, like when they walk by, because these are like when we do like cognitive interviews with people, when we're trying to get like walk through your experience, what did you hear? What did you see? What did you feel? What did you taste? What did you smell? Things like that. When you can replay in your mind walking by somebody and you're like, they were definitely tall. And it wasn't like years later. It was like that day, like that night, the next day. She's like, no, the guy we walked by was definitely taller than me. Like I could, like I'm comfortable with that because is it 100% accurate? No, but for me, like when I'm looking, like what is a person saying? It's like Betsy Blair saying, yeah, I looked at this guy way out on the platform and I think he was about 5'10". That doesn't mean anything to me. That doesn't, you know, it's nothing that's going to sway me one way or the other. But when somebody's like, yeah, I walked past this guy. I remember when I walked past him, I said hello. She talks about the look he was giving her. That he kind of gave them a look, you know, until it tells me like she remembered that specifically. She's looking in his eyes. I think, you know, I'm comfortable with the fact that she's, you know, she knows when she was looking in his eyes, she was looking up and not down at him. Like that to me. And again, as I said last week, like two things can be true at the same time. It very well could be that those girls saw someone that was not Richard Allen and that Betsy Blair saw Richard Allen. Like the timing. The timing is possible for these things to have both happened. So like by me saying that, I'm not saying that because I don't believe they saw Richard Allen, that Richard Allen is innocent. I'm just saying that I don't believe the person they saw was Richard Allen. I just can't reconcile. I can't do the mental gymnastics for me to reconcile that when they're both, one saying I'm 5'7", he's taller than me, probably about 5'10". The other one doesn't say how tall she is, but she says she only came up to like, she's, again, it's a weird way to say it, but and I'm not sure that's what she meant because that would make her very short. But saying that, you know, I came up to like his upper forearm, I assume she means his upper arm, but we don't know how tall that person is. But again, you know, when they both walk by somebody, they're both clear that, you know, he was wearing a face covering, that he didn't respond when she said hello, and that he was taller than both of them. There's no evidence of the contrary other than if you're like, I want that to be Richard Allen. There's just no evidence in that statement to say that's Richard Allen.
Right. And yet you have the confusing element of also, by the way, two different sketches and the issue of everyone looking at the video of Bridge Guy and saying, yes, that's who I saw.
Right.
So you have those things tying it together. Ugh, it's just eyewitness stuff is just so uncomfortable for me. I kind of throw it all away. I understand what you're saying about anchors, but it just gets so hard because if the anchors don't match, I don't know. I just, part of me is like, I don't want to like pick something that sort of works for whatever I think might be true and then decide that has more value than another piece. I know that's not what you're doing, but I'm sure that it could be conceived that way if you think he's guilty. I don't know.
Here's the problem with this whole thing. The big rub is, most likely, when you look at this, right, you have these four girls see this man. They say that's Bridge Guy. Then Betsy Blair sees the man out there. And if I was doing an analysis on those statements, I would say, yeah, they saw the same guy. They saw Bridge Guy. Bridge Guy is tall. I wouldn't say 5'10", but I'd say taller than 5'7". Easy enough. The rub comes in because Richard Allen says it's sometime around that time he walked the trail, walked out, and stood on a platform on the bridge. That's where the rub comes in, because it's like none of the evidence presented, there is nothing. And people may get mad about this, but this is the fact. None of the witness evidence that came out, none of the testimony, the witnesses were there, give any indication, not one bit of that evidence that says it was Richard Allen. Doesn't mean it couldn't be, but there's just like you have to make leaps and assumptions to get there. Right. They're saying he's taller than 5'7". She's saying that, you know, Betsy Blair says, I think it's a younger guy. I think, you know, probably average height, whatever. Like, none of that is Richard Allen.
Right.
None of it. But Richard Allen said he was there and was standing on that platform. And then it's like, well, it puts you in this. This is why I've been left in the category of reasonable doubt, because I'm like, well, if I just look at Betsy Blair's statement and Richard Allen's statement, then I'm like, well, yeah, she didn't describe the right height or age or anything, but she was far away and she wasn't paying that close of attention. Eyewitness identification totally could have been Richard Allen, probably was Richard Allen. But when then you throw in the other two girls, it's like, well, they're saying they saw the same guy and he for sure was taller than 5'7". It couldn't be Richard Allen.
It's maddening.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And that's the reality of it. For someone like me, that despite what anybody might think, really doesn't have a bias in this case, I'm really just trying to get to the bottom of it. Like,
bias is the bias of the United States, like, court system, which is supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. I mean, I think that's your bias. Your bias is, I am going to assume this person didn't do it until you give me enough, at least as pertains to whether they can merit a conviction. Not necessarily innocent,
right?
But like, I am supposed to give you the presumption of innocence until proven otherwise. Prove that to me. I think you could argue that's your bias, but like, that is supposed to be the bias of our entire country. It's just hard sometimes.
But I would say that I think that my feelings on this go beyond that, because from a factual standpoint, if I'm not even looking at like reasonable doubt standards, if I'm just looking at practically speaking, does the evidence, am I convinced? Because there are those cases where I'm like, I think this is probably the guy, but I have reasonable doubt. That's not where I'm at here. Where I'm at here is, God damn it, I don't know. Yeah. I just don't know.
Yeah,
I can look at those three statements together and confidently say, in my opinion, in my estimation, that was not Richard Allen. Couldn't have been. Add in Richard Allen's statement about when he was there, and I'm like, how was it not him?
Well, how do we? Okay, so and do they say in the they say in court, like, does the prosecution say, no, there was no other lone man between the hours of blank and blank? There was literally no other person this can be. And maybe they do. They probably do, because people really believe that he's guilty, and that has to be a big part of it. Is there is no other lone man, period, in this 3-hour block. There's no one else.
So I have not read all of the transcript, so I can't say they didn't. In the testimony that I've been through, I have not seen that being declared. That said, I could see that being something a prosecutor would say in closing arguments, because that's not evidence and they can make those types of leaps.
Okay.
But I don't know how they could know that.
Another little height moment from Jason, and then I'll circle back and say, I'll do the first part of Jason's, but Jason says, to me, the common consistency to everyone who saw a strange man on the trail around the time of the murders was the height. Honestly, what I get from those isn't an exact estimate of height. It's the height that was seemingly unremarkable to them. Nobody's first instinct was to say, I saw an unusually short man on the trail that day dressed like this. You sort of address that as like, what is average?
But I think he makes a good point that kind of goes in that, I think the way Anya put it, kind of just like from a practical standpoint. Yeah, it wasn't that they said he's 5'10 or 5'7 or how tall he was. It's just that what you would kind of expect if someone was recalling seeing Richard Allen is that they noticed a remarkably short man. Like, he does have a characteristic of him that is unique in the fact that he is so short. And no one, we're talking about what range do we have and blah, blah, blah. But no one said, yeah, I saw a really short guy, or I even saw a short guy. No one described the person they saw as noticeably short. And I think that's one of the things that, again, it weighs on me. It's like, I don't know. It's a lot to try to sort through.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Jason also says, well, I'll read Kathy's and then Jason's. Are there others that came forward about being there, but it was too early for Bridge guys, so they were dismissed? That goes to kind of what I was asking Kathy. Sorry to Trump to like get in front of you on that. Is it possible with an earlier timeline for Richard Allen that he saw three girls earlier
And the guy the four girls saw was Bridge Guy, but not Richard Allen. So let's address that.
Is it so? First of all, I was already thinking about the first question before the second question, because I may have to have you circle back to that second piece of that. The first part, so Lynn is, and again, a lot of this stuff, people who know more about, you know, if they've gone through like a lot of the detectives' testimonies and things like that, you know, where some of this other information about the investigate, because a lot of the things we're talking about are things that I would be looking at in the investigative file, not the trial transcripts.
Got it.
Because that's the source information, because the prosecutor's only putting on the witnesses that are going to support their case. The prosecutor's not going to put on a witness that says, yeah, I saw another guy there too.
Right.
They're not going to do that. But that tip may exist in the file somewhere, and I just don't know about it.
And you would hope defense would then find that person and put them on.
You would hope so. Lynn says in the chat that there was a male photographer there. She says she thinks at like 3 or 3:15.
That does ring a bell.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's very possible. Yeah. I don't know. What was the other part they were asking, if it's possible for...
With the earlier timeline that Richard Allen kind of corrects to much later, that he saw three girls earlier, and that the guy that the four girl group saw was Bridge Guy, but not Richard Allen.
Okay, so I mentioned this in last week's follow-up because a listener had pointed it out. I think Kat had pointed it out. So I did a little research into this. And this is another one of those things that gets, I think, has kind of taken on, it's making its own gravy, so to speak, where there's more, people are putting more on the story than is actually there. So, you know, I've heard several people say that, you know, post-trial researchers have found there was a group of three girls that were there that day earlier in the day. And that is probably that's likely the group that Richard Allen saw. So from what, and maybe there's more to this, but from everything I was able to find, and I spent quite a bit of time searching for where this information came from, there was something like a Facebook post that somebody took a screenshot of two girls who said they were at the city park that day, which is kind of like, there's like the city park that leads, the trail kind of starts there, leads to the Freedom Bridge Trail, and then continues on to the Monon High. So they were like on the trail, somewhere near the trail. There was two of them. Somehow it got conflated. There was a third one that could have been with them. So, and it was like around, like from this Facebook post, like this happened like around noon. And so the reality, from what I could find, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong about that, we have some evidence that there was two or three girl group at the park that day around noon. There is no statement that I was able to find from them that says they were ever on the trail. I think there was some kind of post where they said something like they were planning to go to the bridge that day, but no evidence of like if they did, when they did, if they saw Richard Allen, if they were identified as him. They are not brought up in the appeals brief. You know, I was looking forward to, you know, is this some new evidence that's coming out? So this just seems like one of those things where like internet sleuths, which, you know, that's what we're all about, right? I'm all about, you know, ordinary people going to find information, dug this up, but it was never, it has not been like run down or proven or even strongly suggested that Richard Allen actually saw these three girls. That they're like, yeah, I saw a guy. I think I did see that. Like that doesn't exist. And it wasn't strong. Now I say that this is a direct appeal, so they can only base it on trial evidence, but you know, these attorneys have been known to try to slip stuff in to get it out there.
Right.
But yeah, I from what I saw on it, I didn't walk away from reading on it thinking, oh, yeah, there it is. There's the group of three girls. It's just like this maybe three girls that were possibly there somewhere around noon.
Yeah.
So that could have happened. Is it possible, to get back to kind of the core of the question, for Richard Allen to have been there with his earlier timeline and not been the guy that like Betsy Blair? Yeah, absolutely. If Richard Allen got there at like 12 or 12:30, you know, he walked out to the bridge, stood there for a little bit and left. He could have been there and gone before the group of four girls got there, before Abby and Libby got there, before Betsy Blair got there. And it could be somebody completely different. That is possible.
Yeah.
That happened.
Yeah, that is kind of, I think we're all hovering around those same kind of questions in a lot of the listener feedback. Jeanette also was like, is wondering, you know, how many men were in the park? Like what we were just talking about. Sorry, Jeanette, I jumped around so much. And again, I didn't have time to give this a full and thorough review. Appreciate your thinking very much along the lines of what we've been talking about. And then, yeah, Jason's note is very similar, that the idea of making a statement there was no other group of girls, they knew everyone who was there,
how could, yeah, and just, yeah, the feeling of just, I want to be more certain of that being true, and the losing of like interviews and stuff at the beginning of the case and the investigation doesn't help with that. It's very unfortunate that that happened, because all I'm asking for is just like a little bit more reassurance. And
I tell you, the thing that would help immensely is the stuff of Michael, which, by the way, Michael Osbrook, Michael, if you're listening, Michael's been texting me about some stuff. Every time you text me, Michael, because I know he's listening to all this stuff. I've been right smack dab in the middle of an insane pile of stuff that I'm doing. I'm not ignoring you. I just want to make sure that I had my shit all in one sack before I emailed you back or text you back. I am going to get back to you. But, you know, what he mentioned to us, all the surveillance cameras, if we can like find those, because that would be, to me, that would, at least in my mind, it would kind of seal the deal for me. If we're able to pull all these surveillance and know for sure, okay, there's Richard Allen's car, there's where he is. That's, and if it's like, oh yeah, he got to the park at 12 o'clock and he left the park, drove away at 1:30 and was seen driving down at 1:45, is seen driving on the other side of town. Obviously easy enough. If it's, okay, we see him pulling up to the park at 1:30 and then doesn't leave until, you know, 4 o'clock or somewhere like that, then obviously that's going to cut the other way. Cause, you know, if he shows up at 1:30, which is what was in the original statement, the way it was written by Doolin, that, you know, we know that the group of four girls, they took a timestamped photo at a park bench at 1:26 when they were back. So I think they were either on the other side of Freedom Bridge, wherever they are, but they were on their way back to the park or back to the car, the drive parking lot. And we know sometime after that they ran into Richard. So like if he got there at 1:30, they took a picture at 1:26, say like 1:40, they pass each other. Then that puts him out on the bridge around 2 o'clock, about the time Betsy Blair gets there. Like that would be very hard to argue against if we could get all those surveillance camera, get all that footage that Michael has talked about when he's been on the show. Hey, everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday Follow-Up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here. And you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Just to circle back to this, too, it's a great question, Sarah. Was Betsy Blair the only one who says she saw the girls on the trail that day? Abby and Libby, that is, right? Is she the only one who says she saw the girls? Does the other set of four girls not seeing Abby and Libby tell us anything time-wise?
So, yes, as far as that trial, the only one that said that they saw Abby and Libby there, other than the person who dropped them off and, you know, Kelsey, who saw them earlier, the only one who saw them on the trail that testified was Betsy Blair. As far as the group of four girls, it's irrelevant because they, and I'm working from memory, but I think I have these times right. That picture on the park bench was 126. After that is when they walked back. He said the one girl estimated they probably saw Richard Allen around 215, but she wasn't sure about that. She was basing that on the fact that they got back to her friend's house at 220 or something like that. Abby and Libby arrived at the trails at like 149. So with them, so if we go by the timestamps, at 126, they're on the park bench, they leave, they very easily could have then, well, and they did. I don't think anybody's lying about seeing Abby and Libby, you know, that they are by one, you know, 20 minutes later, they're leaving the park and that's when Abby and Libby get there.
Okay. Let's talk about, I know we got to go, but let's talk about the Sarah Carbaugh stuff really quickly, because I definitely remember thinking this during the time of the trial, and I don't remember the answer. And similarly, Doreen has a question about it. Doreen says, where is the spot that Sarah Carbaugh saw the bloody/muddy man in relation to Ron Logan's property? And then my question to circle back on, because I'm sure this has been answered, but I don't remember, is like, what kind of road is that? How often is it traveled? How remote is that road? I guess I'm just trying to wrap my head around the idea of someone being covered in blood walking on a major thoroughfare or even a not major thoroughfare to then be seen by people in that condition. I guess that's what I'm trying to establish is like, where did this happen and how could that happen? No offense to Sarah. I'm not saying she didn't see something.
In relation to Ron Logan's house, I think it's on the same side of the creek as Ron Logan's house. So, where the bodies were found, it's on the side, you know, that they cross the bridge, go down bottom of the creek bottom. The bodies are found up the hill on the other side a little bit. If you continued up that hill out, there's Ron Logan's property. There's the road. So that's the answer in relation to that. As far as the road itself, I don't know. I mean, I've looked at it on a map. I couldn't tell you how heavily it's certainly not like a big secluded road. It's the main road that goes to that park. I mean, there's car. Yeah, I don't know. I agree. I said this before. I think I said it last week. To me, Sarah Carbaugh's testimony, and nothing against her, but I don't know. There's too much for me to put much weight into that. And it's not like we have to weigh it real heavily because she, you know, described somebody who absolutely was Richard Allen. She didn't. She drove by, saw a guy. But yeah, the whole thing that, you know, like when she came forward about it, that it was mud. She described light colored, like tan pants, and then like later changed that to dark pants and then said that it was the mud that made it look lighter, but it was actually blue or dark or whatever she said. And then it was like it was only muddy and then it became bloody. And then she is, you know, then there's I'm sure she's doing her best.
Right.
You know, but I did not read her testimony feeling like I could take anything useful away from it.
But I guess my question is, because in the attempt at non-analysis that analysis snuck in with her statements in your recap for us in this episode, you said it doesn't really necessarily do much in either direction. But there was a reason that they put her on the stand, one assumes. And so I'm wondering, like, is it because it ties him to where they thought his car was parked? There has to be a reason that they wanted her to testify, right?
Yeah, I think the dot they're connecting is the later picture they put up of, and I didn't read this part of the testimony, but the screenshot of the Hoosier Harvest, whatever, surveillance of Richard Allen's car. So they're kind of, I think it's kind of like they have it clocked. They know when her car drove by. She says she saw him. And then like later, here's this car that they're saying is Richard Allen's car. So I think that's what it like connects that dot. It's like, okay, she says she sees this muddy, bloody man walking away. And then right after that, look, here's Richard Allen's car driving by.
Right. And Kevin and Anya, if you end up hearing this for some reason, I'm sure that a lot of this is in the book. I took a copious notes when I was listening to the book, but I genuinely have so many notes that like it's hard for me to even go through because I was marking a bunch of facts and, you know, things that were testified to and stuff. Mm-hmm. I need to go back and comb through all of those. So if there's something that you answer in the book definitively that I'm just not remembering, I'm sorry. I'm not able to like pull it up on my notes easily. But yeah. Okay. And then just the very last thing was actually the first thing that you put on the outline, but I thought it was maybe a good way to go out, which is the usual idiot from Patreon. This is their username. You said that you believe Richard Allen should not have been convicted because of the evidence presented at trial. There simply wasn't enough to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. I completely agree with that assessment. What I'm curious about is why you're still not comfortable saying that Richard Allen is innocent. Is there something in the evidence or something you've learned during your investigation that makes you think Richard Allen could be guilty? Or is your reluctance to call him innocent more about the fact that we still don't know with certainty who committed these murders?
No, I mean, I think if I had to pin it down to a thing, it's the combination of Betsy Blair's statement and testimony and Richard Allen's statement about being on the bridge. That's really it for me. I am not, as much as I've said, like I'm uncomfortable with the conviction and the proofs, I would also be very uncomfortable saying, yeah, Richard Allen's innocent. They got the wrong guy. To be honest with you, I was getting real close to that after talking to Kevin and Anya. As I mentioned, just the way my brain works, like after talking to them, I'm like, oh, well, I mean, they are like, they literally wrote the book on guilt. And that argument didn't convince me at all. Like, that's just, it's all the stuff I already knew. There's nothing there. So I was getting closer to saying, yeah, I don't think, in my opinion, I don't think he was the guy. And then I went through those transcripts and I read the testimony and I'm like, I see. And again, it's not anything to do with the way they presented it, but it was, for some reason, it didn't seem as definitive to me.
I think they've just been living with the details, living inside of the details for so long. It's really hard to step back and realize that if someone is coming in cold or like is confused about something, you know what I'm saying? It's just hard to like they've always said, it's really hard to be like, here's 5 minutes. Got it. Guilty. Let's move on. It's hard to boil all of that down.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And also, I think during the conversation, I was getting distracted by, you know, just the way my mind works. You know, when they were talking about, you know, that this was the only group of three girls that were on the trail that day. It's like I kind of lost the forest for the trees. I'm like, wait, how do we know that?
Right, right.
You know, and I kind of missed the point that they were making, which is he puts himself on that bridge, on that platform, according to his original statement, at the same time that Betsy Blair says she saw Bridge Guy on the platform and then passed Abby and Libby walking towards the bridge. Like, so yeah, that's the long and short of it. Like I said, I don't want to keep rehashing the whole thing over and over again, but it's very, I cannot say that I'm comfortable or that I'm convinced that he is innocent, even though I do not think that Wilbur and Voorhees described Richard Allen. Mm-hmm. I do not think that they saw him. If I take Betsy Blair's statement combined with theirs and even in isolation hers, I see nothing there to say that who she saw was Richard Allen. But then Richard Allen said he was like literally in the exact same spot at around the exact same time that Betsy Blair saw the person who I am convinced is Bridge Guy, that, you know, is the killer. So, yeah, I mean, that if everything I've gone through so far, like, that's the one piece for me that's like, it would be disingenuous for me to say, to try to explain that away.
Right.
I cannot explain that away.
Especially when I feel very, very uncomfortable with him making it. I feel, like you said before, I feel pretty comfortable with that note about what time he originally said being right. I don't think that guy, you know, massaged it, turned it in, because he didn't think, like, he wasn't chasing Richard Allen. He, like, wrote it down, put it in a card and walked away from it. It's not like he had alarm bells going off and was like, this is my guy. Like, it just, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
He wasn't manipulating anything because it was so unimportant overall at the beginning that, like, it just kind of got lost in the shuffle. So I don't feel like that was a manipulated note, which to me then feels like Richard Allen, for whatever reason, guilty or not guilty, but scared, then put himself there an hour earlier, many, many years later when, you know, his feet were on the coals, I cannot not give that first time the priority and the weight. And the weight is on. And you know what's ironic? And then we for sure can go. What's ironic is that what I remember Jim Clemente, like the thing that he just kept saying, which I was so mad about at the time, because I was like, that's such a, it's such an oversimplification, was he kept saying, he put himself there. He put himself there. And I was like, Jim, it's so much more complicated than that. And what's hilarious right now, as I'm hearing you say that, is like, I mean, you are kind of saying the same thing that Clemente was saying, that I was like, that's such an oversimplification. I'm not saying you guys are right or wrong. I just think it's funny.
Yeah. And in ways, I think it is an oversimplification, because like what you said, I agree with. Do I think that Doolin manipulated that to try to frame Richard Allen? Nope. Do I think that Richard Allen probably said 1:30 in that first interview? Yep. Am I 100% convinced that he's right about that time? Nope.
Yeah.
So, and you have to look at what I try to do with all these is, what if he was guilty? He did it. He knows he did it. He makes the phone call, volunteers, comes forward, and then says, yep, I was there at exactly the time that the killer was there. Is that something a guilty person would do? And this is all like who knows? Maybe.
If you know you saw people and you know what I mean? Like, if you're like, I saw people and they saw me, so I have to be able to acknowledge I was there. Because if I don't come forward and they identify that I was there, that's going to be a real bad look.
That argument is certainly there. There's also the argument that from what the witnesses who actually saw him said, the person they saw was wearing a hat, hood, and a face covering. So how confident would you be sure somebody could identify you if you never did come forward, right? So there's that. But then I look at it like, what if you're innocent? And it's like, what was it, a couple days later? And you find out it's like, oh, they're looking for me. I was there that day. And it's a couple days later. Like, do you think you could confidently say, unless you had some real strong anchor for it, you know, again, I'm not saying he is innocent, but imagine he is innocent, right? He had nothing to do with this. He's just coming forward to let him know he was there, let him know what he saw. And you don't think you're a suspect. You don't think that this is not an interrogation. You're just trying to give information. What time are you there? You had said that you thought about 1 o'clock. And I think it was more like 1:30. They write down 1:30. And then that becomes the time. That's then later you're on trial and that becomes the time. Is it possible when you said, I think it was 1:30, that it was actually 12:30? Now, does that mean that years later when he's like, it was 12:30 for sure? Am I confident in that? No, of course, at that point. Anybody innocent or guilty is going to be like, no, it was earlier. It was before that. So yeah, there's still more nuance than that. That's why I wish we had that surveillance footage, because I don't know. I am curious, and I'm going to look into this. We don't have time now, Purple from chat, but she put up a name that is ringing a bell, but I'm drawing a blank right now. She just, so you guys know, for those of you that do know more about the case, she put in the chat, when you dig into it more, you'll probably agree that Betsy Blair saw Daniel Pearson. She's not saying that he was Bridge Guy, by the way, but that's who she saw. And one of the things that Michael said to me was, there's no way that Betsy Blair saw, in one of the texts he sent, no way that Betsy Blair saw Ron Logan as part of the conversation last week. So there's something I'm missing there. I need to figure out who Daniel Pearson is and why that is who she probably saw. So I'll circle back to that maybe in next week's follow-up, because I'm curious about that. But yeah, I mean, that's a really long answer to your question, that usual idiot or whatever your name is usually on Patreon, your handle. Yeah, I cannot in good faith and being genuine say, I can look at all this and be like, yep, I'm sure he's innocent. Mainly because of Betsy Blair and his own statement. When you put Betsy Blair's statement and Richard Allen's statements together, I would be lying if I said that's not meaningful to me.
Yeah. Well, and we have still some more to go. Bless your heart for saying, I'm staying out of this case. I'm not going to be an expert on this case. And then I know your brain and you're just like, if I could just get a little more information, if I could just process these pieces by myself, if I could just, I know you're a dog with a bone and I know that like you respect all the conversations you've had and you're like, well, they all experienced the facts for themselves and came to a conclusion. I probably should also do that. And the next thing you know, you've spent hours and days and weeks on something.
I've spent as many episodes of this as some of our own cases. Yeah,
I'm not making light of what happened. Again, it will haunt me forever, as it haunts all of us, that this happened. It's awful.
Yeah, and that's it is. It's one of those things that it drives me crazy. This case has been something that has eaten at me for years and years and years before Richard Allen was ever a name that we even knew. And then there's also, like, I do look at, like, my obligation as the host of the show to my listeners. Like, when I, you know, when I have people coming to me asking to, they're like, you know, everybody's got their spin on it. You know, give us the fact. Tell us what's really going on here. So I'm done rambling. You got shit to do. It's been an hour.
I know.
Gotta shut up.
Fascinating. It's fascinating. And I think Zach said it best last week. I believe it was last week, which is, please understand, like, I'm firmly in the camp of let's not have false convictions and let's not put innocent people in prison. But if I'm honest to my core, I'm much more troubled by is the right person for Abby and Libby. And you can call that bullshit if you want. And I have if Richard Allen, but it's an if for me. And since it's an if, the thing that is haunting me and driving me to want to be here for these conversations, and I know it's true for Zach and you, is the thing that I'm horrified by is what if Abby and Libby are not getting justice? Genuinely, I'm sorry to say that is more important to me than whether Richard Allen is in prison when he shouldn't be. And I know that's not fair, but that is where my driving core comes from. And I'm just trying to be honest about that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think those are great last words for this episode. Let's go ahead and wrap this thing up. Everybody, thanks for tuning in. And hopefully, I mean, it seems like you guys are still interested in it. I've got two more episodes coming. Make sure you tune in on Sunday. I'm going to give you the real facts, what was actually said about the firearms evidence, what was actually testified to regarding the height range of Bridge Guy and what Libby said in the video, the gun racking piece, all that stuff, is all that kind of hotspot stuff is going to come out on Sunday. Talk about all that next week. And that's it. I'm done.
Thanks, everybody. Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.